Support for Brave Public is provided by Livewire, offering audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery services for conferences, meetings, and live events, serving the Prairie region and clients nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this Sunday, we celebrate a major milestone for a beloved homegrown radio show and its unmistakable host. Our program manager, Eric Dethridge, has this conversation with the host and the person who knows him best.
Well, you know his voice. I mean, it kind of sticks out a little bit compared to the Midwest tones you normally hear on Prairie Public. But hey, that's a good thing, because every time you hear Jack Russell Weinstein, you know you're going to get a thought-provoking conversation that's accessible, yet doesn't insult your intelligence on things in life, big and small, through the lens of a popular UND philosophy teacher you wish you always had. Hey, Dr. Jack, welcome.
I am happy to be here, although I am not the one with the accent. You are the one with the accent.
we're the strange ones. Well, I have actually not even a Midwest accent, although, you know, I think I may have lost my Baltimoreese over the years. It's kind of smoothed out a little less cockneyed.
My New Yorker comes out when I get angry and excited.
Oh, boy.
And so do the words that I can't say on the radio, but that's part of the New York experience.
Well, I hope if we hear it, Jack, it's the excitement part that we're going to hear. But we brought along another voice that you're probably familiar with. You hear her with some of the credits on the show, and she was even a guest at one point on philosophical discussions about everyday life. Your wife, Dr. Kim Donhauer.
Hello.
Right. Hi. Yep. It's good to have you both, Kim and Jack, and I'm talking to you because of a milestone, a 200th one to be exact, 200 episodes of Why. How are you both feeling about it?
It's pretty exciting and connected with the fact that we're monthly and so that it's been 18 years. That's the thing that adds such power to the 200, because I can't even fathom. I can count to 10 pretty well, but 200, that's a lot in 18 years. So much water under the bridge, so many people, so many ideas that challenged me that I find myself reflecting on 5, 10, 15 years later, and that really helped me understand the whole shebang, the whole connectedness of all of the knowledge. It humbles me to think about how much my guests and my listeners have contributed to my understanding of the world.
Do you agree with that, Kim? Do you see it through a little bit different lens?
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's interesting from my perspective is because the topic changes from month to month, is it means that Jack is always reading about, like, it could be the philosophy of anything, right? And so that will affect just conversations we have in the house, things we talk about. And so there's this wonderful sort of randomness of like, oh, this month the intellectual theme is philosophy of gardening. And next month it might be, you know, NCAA sports. And so there's always something different to talk about, to think about. But then also how many times Jack will refer back to one of the shows, you know, and say, I was thinking of this, but, you know, it was like the show when. He clearly has every episode in his head, remembered, cross-connected, filed away.
To that point, you learn a lot from doing these episodes. I mean, you know a lot of stuff. You read everything, and you have a memory like no other, according to your wife. But what do you learn over these 18 years? What have you learned about yourself, about life, just by doing this show that you wouldn't have learned otherwise?
The most important thing that I retained is the joy of performing discovery. And what I mean by that, and I really enjoy this about teaching as well, we have no models in our popular culture of people who are thinking on the camera. You ask a politician, you ask a talking head, they have the answer pat in the exact words instantaneously, and everything happens so quickly and everyone's fighting with each other. And you don't get to see people think, and you don't get to see people be wrong, and you don't get to see people internalize the ideas that someone else is presenting for you. And so independent of individual ideas and specific insights, the thing that stays with me the most is what a tremendous joy it is to be imperfect and to compute the internalization in front of people so I can advocate for the audience as the host, but while I'm advocating for the audience, it is giving me permission to fully integrate these ideas in a way that maybe I wouldn't have if it was a one-way conversation.
And I've heard you say, Jack, before that when you first started doing the show, you know, it was mainly about the topics, mainly about your guests, and it took you a little while to feel comfortable in the shoes of the host and that the audience is vested in you, the radio personality. How has that realization evolved for you over the years?
As a philosopher, it felt very narcissistic to think of it in terms of me rather than the topic. And I had assumed that people would tune in because they were interested in the philosophy of suicide or music, the logic of jazz or something. And then I started to see that people would refer to it as Jack's show and who is Jack talking about? And this sense that the audience imbued with me a kind of trust is really meaningful. I get a lot of feedback from my best friend, Gail, who long-term listeners will know that I talk about all the time on the show. And one of the things she says is, oh, you had another show that I had absolutely no interest in at all. And I thought it was going to be completely boring. And then I listened to it and I thought it was fascinating. And that sense of trust in me as a conversation partner allowed me to get past that fear of calling attention to myself, because it really is a gift for people to feel like they have that kind of relationship with me.
Well, you know, we all have relationships with radio personalities we grew up with. We even imagine what they look like. We imagine like what they're like at home, doing the dishes, taking out the trash. So since we have your better half in here,
now be nice.
Might as well ask the source, what is Jack, the radio personality, like in real life?
I'll tell you a story. When Jack and I first met, we were both living in California, teaching at Fresno State University, and I'm from the English department, and I got invited to a dinner party at the philosophy department. And after the conversation there, on the way home, I said to Jack, you guys are never not philosophers, are you?
That had to be a dinner party.
Jack is never not a philosopher in the way that he thinks about things and his ready access to all kinds of ideas, how they're connected to each other, his ability to explain those things. But one of the things that is so interesting to me is that philosophy is known for the way they sort of help each other think about things is to attack each other's ideas, mm-hmm. right? And I've found Jack as, you know, the show and having to be an interviewer and that advocate for the audience, he really has this different method now that I think works just as well as the attack each other's ideas to help people, you know, think better. He's really good at drawing out, simply because of interest, of just very intense interest and listening, drawing out people's ideas, restating them in different ways to make sure he understands, but also the audience understands. And so he's the perfect person to have a conversation with if you've got an idea about something, but it needs development. We were doing that on the way down here today for something that I'm writing. I said, you know, I need you to help me think about this kind of thing. So he's the kind philosopher instead of the stereotypical, but what about this? You're wrong about that.
Right.
philosopher that I think you might see if you went to the American Philosophical Association.
Well, one of my favorite little bits about our marriage is I will get a text and Kim will say, I have a question about something.
I call this dial of philosopher.
Yeah, she calls it dial of philosopher. And it's, you know, what could be better than your spouse valuing the things that you have to say?
Well, also, too, you don't turn off the academia, the great stimulating conversation. You happen to have that at home with an equal, and that has to be pretty exciting.
It is. It's great. Kim plays a tremendous role, obviously, in my day-to-day life, in my figuring out ideas and molding things. But what I think everyone should know is that she's also the first reader of the monologue. Every episode starts with a 5 or 6 minute discussion of me talking about themes and ideas, and she edits them. And she looks at them and tells me if something works and tells me if something doesn't. She's a fabulous editor. This idea isn't clear. Maybe move this paragraph. But the joy of coming up to her attic office and her saying, this was excellent. This was really good. I don't have very comments. That's a real accomplishment. And as the first reader, she's also in many ways, right, the most important reader. Yeah. Because if I can't get it past her, it's not good. And if I can get it past her, I don't have to worry about it being good.
It sounds like, Kim, you have a pretty good BS detector. And
I do. And, you know, and actually one of the ways that working with the monologues made me a better editor is because I used to work as a book editor. And mm-hmm. So my attitude used to just sort of be all business of like, okay, fix this, move this, do this, do that. And then Jack would say, did you like any of it? And I'd realize, oh, I need to, you know, to tell him,
touch, yeah.
I need to tell him that too. But also, I mean, what that has let us do is like, there's sometimes certain moves he'll make in a monologue that I think work really well for the audience. And so it lets me suggest sometimes of like, or notice, you know, you didn't do that thing you usually do in the monologue. Like what if you did that? You know, so the benefits of the softer touch, but also of emphasizing what's working as well as just fixing what's not.
It's great to have somebody you trust and somebody you want to please at the same time. it's a good thing. When did you both come to North Dakota? When was that? And Kim, you're from Asheville, North Carolina, one of the most beautiful towns that you could think of with the thriving art scene and a lot of mountains. And Grand Forks obviously has none. Jack, you being from Washington Heights, New York City, sidewalks everywhere, buildings rising up. So what was that culture shock like? When was it? And describe your feelings when you first moved here.
So we moved in 2001, August of 2001, from Central California, which is where we had met. We were both teaching at Fresno State.
It's the ugly California. It's not the nice.
Yeah, it's not the pretty California. Well,
Fresno and
is in Bakersfield are always the joke.
Right.
The
joke. Fresno's airport code is what? Fat.
Is fat. Yeah. Yes.
Which
it is.
Nothing wrong with that. Anyway.
It is. Yeah. And both of us felt like we didn't quite fit on the West Coast culturally to begin with. So part of our first reaction was that the Midwest felt a little more comfortable than the West Coast had in certain ways, in that it was easier to talk to people. People didn't seem quite as standoffish in our experience in California. And we also loved that we didn't have to get in a car to go absolutely anywhere, that it was possible to walk. Otherwise, in terms of culture shock, I mean, for me, the flatness was really hard. I'm a mountain person. And there was a moment we were driving the two cars and it was before cell phones, we had walkie-talkies to talk to each other. And when we made the turn at Fargo to get on 29 and it somehow got even flatter, I got on the walkie-talkie to Jack and said, I don't know if I can do this. But I have grown to appreciate the flat landscape, though I still exhale every time I go back to Asheville and see the mountains. The culture shock part for me actually was primarily about the students, because I'd gone to graduate school at the University of Minnesota. And so I thought, well, I've taught students from, you know, the upper Midwest. But UND students are indeed the quietest students I've ever taught. And I've taught in Maryland, North Carolina, Minnesota, California. They often don't even give you facial expressions. You know, you have no idea how you're doing. And everyone who comes here has to develop a repertoire of strategies to get them to talk. We all come up with different ones. But, you know, listening to things Jack was just saying, I feel like even after 25 years, I'm still trying to understand and figure out all of the different reasons why they don't talk. And I think the part about emotion is really key, because I remember a moment I was teaching a literature class. We had read Kafka's The Metamorphosis, which begins with a man waking up, finding out that he has turned into a giant cockroach. And an actual real discussion broke out among the students about whether this was a dream or we were supposed to think this was real. And the conversation, it turned into a debate. And I could see a student in the front getting so upset and so uncomfortable. And finally she said, you guys, stop. It's just a story. And I leaned forward and I said, shh, I live for this moment. You know, but emotion being attached to ideas about something fictional, you could tell she wanted to get up and leave the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. It made her really uncomfortable. So I think understanding what all needs to happen to make these students comfortable talking in a classroom, talking about ideas, talking about, you know, fiction, that's been the biggest adjustment. And then people need to use more spices in their food. I know that's I know that's a cliche, but they do.
They're getting there, maybe just a little bit, incrementally every year, right?
This won't be a surprise given what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. but for me, the hardest thing has been having such a large personality and liking the interaction of strangers in a way that a lot of folks in the region aren't comfortable with. And so I often give this scenario of the different places that we've lived. And I say, in New York, if you're waiting online in the grocery store and you make a joke to strangers, they laugh and talk back to you. In California, if you're online and you make a joke to someone, they think you're hitting on them and you want to take them home. In North Dakota, you make a joke and you talk to strangers, they look at you because they think you're going to kill them in their sleep.
That's hilarious.
And that sense of public decorum mm-hmm. has been hard for me, but of course, what you get more than anything else here that I can't imagine another place that I would have gotten is this sense of being connected to and educating and contributing to a community. When we first got here, the university will do this bus tour for the new faculty. They'll either go in the north or the south end. And so we did the north end. And I especially, and I'd spent a year in small town Kentucky, but it still wasn't as rural as North Dakota. And we drove the North End, and every town we stopped, we would have, you know, lunch in someone's garage, and every doctor would be from UND, and every lawyer would be from UND. And there was this sense of meaningfulness, and you really get the sense of educating and participating in a community. I had a colleague who passed away a few years ago, but he had been at UND for 44 years. And I think I once figured out that 2% of the state had been in his classroom. That is an incredible gift that I wouldn't get if I was still at Fresno State, that we wouldn't get if we were at Harvard, right? I mean, I think it's nice to feel useful. It's nice to feel like you have a skill that maybe other people don't have, and so you're valuable. And I remember one day I was going to vote, you know, for some election, and I go give my ID, and the woman checks me in, and she looks up, she goes, how's the radio show going? And
nice.
What can I ask for more than that? Our various deans who do fundraising and stuff will often talk about being on some ranch and the rancher talking about the radio show and knowing that on a Sunday when we're doing the broadcast version that people are going down 94, you know, heading from Bismarck, listening, that's the flip side of the inability to connect with strangers, is that there's a connectedness that once you are invited into is really, you feel seen, you feel acknowledged, you feel like you're in some kind of reciprocal relationship.
Man, 200 episodes of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. This is to the both of you. What are your favorite, maybe a couple favorite episodes that come to mind?
I mean, I loved being interviewed by Jack, and it took a while for him to convince me to do it. The experience was great in part because, in a way, it was the same as when we, you know, if we're home and I'm talking to him about what I do, but it wasn't. I liked to experience that being drawn out, having a supportive interviewer, someone who wasn't going to sort of be adversarial. Jack always, when he has people who are in philosophy departments on the show, he always has to convince them it's not going to be adversarial. And I'd say 50% of them don't believe him until they're actually on the show and he starts asking questions. So I love the episode where our daughter and her friend got to ask Gloria Steinem some questions about feminism. I think one of the absolute best episodes is the Carol Gilligan episode. That's one where people are shocked to find out that Carol Gilligan wasn't here in the studio with him. It felt like the two of them had known each other their whole lives. Like, there was just this sort of instant rapport. There's some people Jack's interviewed, like our friend Danny Goldhagen, that they know each other already, and I sort of know what the rapport. But I like the ones where I can hear the relationship developing of like, oh, she just realized that he's, you know, really smart. Or she just realized he thought that. Or they're connecting around this idea. I would say those are some of my favorites.
Well, it's like when a guest feels like they're seen or heard.
Yeah.
That's something pretty special.
And you can hear that, right? Mm-hmm. You can hear the moment when they're like, oh, I get to just be excited and talk about what interests and excites me. You know, right. That's always awesome to hear.
That's part of the hidden goal of the monologue. The monologue is there primarily for the audience to start anticipating questions, and so the themes don't really take them by surprise. But also, it is a way for me to announce to the guest, okay, you got to step up your game. This is real. I read the book. I thought about it. I know what I'm talking about. You have permission, and you are expected to rise up to this occasion. And it's why we don't pre-record the monologue. I wait until the guests are here or connected on the phone, on, you know, the internet, and I perform the monologue in front of them while they are listening. Because otherwise, you need to rev up, you need to warm up. And they're all professionals, they're all thoughtful people, they're all experts, and it's a jump start. I think there are a bunch of different categories of episodes that I love. I love the episodes with people I have very close, intimate relationships with. I loved the episode of Kim. For our 10th anniversary, I did a live episode on stage with my father, which I listen to periodically, particularly if I'm missing him or something like that, you know, and that's very meaningful to me. Friends and colleagues whom I have tremendous respect for, those are very, very meaningful for me.
That's Why radio host and UND philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and his wife, UND English professor Dr. Kim Dunhauer, in a conversation with Prairie Public Program Manager Eric Dethridge, celebrating the program's 200th episode, which airs this Sunday. We'll hear more from Jack in the second half of the program, along with some of Jack's friends and family. We'll have more of the conversation on Main Street after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thanks for listening today. If you're just joining us, we're celebrating a Prairie Public milestone on Sunday, the 200th episode of our monthly program, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Our program manager, Eric Dethridge, continues his conversation with Why host Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and his wife and the show's announcer, Dr. Kim Dunhauer. And then after that, you'll hear from some folks who know Jack well, including fellow academics and colleagues, radio collaborators, and another very important member of his family. Jack now talks about some of his favorite guests and moments of the show.
There is the category of people who were intellectual heroes for me, that the idea of being able to talk to them. Carol Gillian is one of them. Her book In a Different Voice was profoundly influential for me when I was younger. And having a conversation with her, having a conversation with James Lowen, having a conversation with people who I really have admired for a long time has meant a lot. And then there's the conversations that teach me that I don't know anything, and the conversations that really help me understand something about the world that I just missed. And those are my favorite kind of books, too. There's a book, I tried to get the author on the show and I couldn't get her, but there's a book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which is like, it's a 600-page book on the Great Migration, the migration of African Americans, descendants of slaves from the rural South right before World War II to the urban cities in the 1970s. And I read that book and I thought, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about history. I don't know anything about people. I don't know anything about, you know, stupid to say the Black experience because that's 27 million things, but I don't know anything. And I read that book and it became one of my most favorite reading experiences, which is why I really wanted the author on the show. That experience of encountering new ideas that shift me on my axis. There's actually, and then there's personal meaningful moments. I have to correct, though it's relevant, Kim said that we knew Danny in advance. We didn't know Danny in advance. Daniel Goldhagen wrote Hitler's Will of the Executioners, which is without question the single best book to explain the Holocaust. And profoundly, again, meaningful to me. And I invited him on the show. And then we became friends because of it. And that in itself was a tremendous gift. But Kim's mentor, Deborah Brandt, is a literacy scholar. And she's on the show actually twice, once to talk about reading and writing, literacy, and once to talk about ghostwriting. And I have always struggled with my identity because both of my parents are artists. My mother is a visual artist. My father is a jazz musician, in addition to their day jobs and things like that. And I grew up with this profound sense that the single most important thing that a human being can do is create art. And that if you're not creating art, you're not doing something meaningful. Now, there's problems with that, but that was my childhood. And I always struggled with not being a fiction writer and not doing all this stuff. And what Deb convinced me, and you can hear it on the radio, I'm getting emotional, is that I'm a writer. That I have spent my whole life doing the one thing that I wanted to do. And understanding that the monologues are writing. Understanding that my philosophy books and things like that are writing. The moments where I can have a real human experience with my audience. Those are the best.
That listener on I-94 that you're connecting with in that moment, that's, to me, that's art. That's writing as well. Mm-hmm. You know, in radio, people don't realize how much writing goes into conversational radio. There's a lot. So
there's so much stuff behind the scenes, and the experts, you, Craig, Ashley, Tay behind the engineering deck recording, all these experts have brought years and years and years of knowledge, mistakes, stuff like that. All that becomes invisible when it's done right. The listener doesn't have to think about all of the effort. And I will say, since I'm already emotional, that my relationship with Prairie Public has been maybe the most consistent and the most meaningful relationship in my professional life. Bill Thomas, who is no longer the director of radio, when I met with him to pitch the show, he said to me, well, let's do 3 episodes and then we'll see what happens. And I always say, he never told me to stop. And I never understood why he agreed to it. And at some point later on, he said to me, I would never have let anyone else do this but you. No idea why. I mean, it's worked out fine, but, you know, don't understand how he saw that in me. Don't understand where the trust came from. And the Prairie Public folks have treated me not just like an equal, but as part of the family from the very first. And were I to lose the show, that would be very hard for me. But were I to lose Prairie Public Radio, I don't know how to deal with that. The fact that Prairie Public is vulnerable right now is such a crime against the community, because there's something tremendously romantic about radio, but there's also something more honest about radio that you don't get in television, even though Prairie Public Television is wonderful. There's something honest and unmediated about the experience of hearing the voices, and you're alone or you're in your car or you have your earbuds in or whatever, and the voice fills you in a way that the visuals don't. And the idea that Prairie Public is vulnerable is baffling to me, because the network is the only network that unifies the entire state. And the radio is the only signal that reaches every single household in the state, not to mention Montana, South Dakota, et cetera, every single household in the state, regardless of economics, regardless of rural or urban, regardless of ethnicity. Are you a new American? Have you been in North Dakota for 7 generations? It reaches everybody with a kind of democratic equality that is unequaled, unrivaled by any other medium. And I get to be a part of that. What more could I ask for?
We could ask for your donation at prairiepublic.org. Just open the red donate link. If that's on a pitch, I don't know what it is. Thanks, Jack.
we are a monthly, sustaining members. Yes. Yeah,
well, thank you for that. So 200 shows in. Look, I mean, yeah, we're facing huge challenges just to exist. We're trying. Our audience keeps stepping up, and we need them to keep stepping up if we're going to stay here for another 200 episodes of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. But assuming we do, what's next for you? Because you talked about, like, you know, trying to get an author of a book, talking about an experience that you'd like to learn more about. There's a lot to learn out there. It's also a different time that we're in. It's an extraordinary time in 2026, different than even, you know, when you all moved out here, which was not too long before 9/11. I mean, we are in this era now where there's a lot of anti-intellectualism, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, there's just so many confluences of things happening all at once. And that, you know, it speaks to your wheelhouse and the things that you care about. What do you have on the docket? What do you have in your mind for the next 200 shows of Why?
Well, one of the things that is really important is that Craig and I do the monthly segment of Philosophical Currents on Main Street. And one of the fundamental differences is that I think of Why as my show and Main Street is Craig's show. Mm-hmm. And I do the interviews in Why, and Craig interviews me in Philosophical Currents. And Philosophical Currents is about current events. And so I can be more political. I can be more topical. I can have, I don't want to say more of an opinion, but it's more frontline stuff. And that frees me in Why to have a more conceptual approach. I would never have a partisan on the show. I mean, obviously, there are some topics that I might not do, but I would never have a partisan on the show, and I would never have someone who has an agenda that isn't primarily intellectual in nature. And so what that allows me to do is have hard conversations in a way that other people don't have the safety and freedom to do. Our last episode was Philosophy of Suicide, right? That's a tough conversation. A couple years ago, we had Philosophy and Depression. That is a tough conversation. But also, I had one of my favorite episodes. We did it here in the studio. We had a Hindu monk in the studio. And I had an episode on Sharia law. And I had an episode on whether or not we could have a world without borders. I had an episode on, I've had episodes on violence and things like that. What allows me to do is to take these conceptual cores and get us to have conversations that hopefully is liberated from the partisan bickering and the one-upmanship and the trying to win the sport of argument. And so I'm constantly looking for stuff that is just interesting. My daughter spent a semester in Florence, Italy as an exchange student. Went to visit her, of course, and she was giving us the tours of the beautiful architecture and art. And I immediately came home and invited a scholar in February. We're having an episode called Do We Still Need the Renaissance? But if it pops into my head, I heard on NPR once this woman who was talking about cuisine, the cooking of empires. And I immediately called her and had her on the show, and that was a wonderful episode. Anything that pops up, if there is a philosophical approach to it, I will consider putting it on the table. And that means I very rarely know what's going to happen 6 months or a year from now. I am currently, I think we've got about 7 or 8 episodes lined up. That's good for me. Sometimes we're really scrambling. So I don't know. It depends what's on the table. It depends what crosses my path and on what people would be interested in.
Well, as you always say in the promo that we still love airing after all these years, why is an empowering question? And it gives you a lot of power to unlock a lot of things. And it's a very liberating word, why. And Kim, you're across from your husband here talking about this 200th episode. And, you know, of course, he was getting emotional, understandably. What are your thoughts about this accomplishment? And what do you have to say to Jack on this milestone?
So you asked us earlier about potential culture shock, mm-hmm. you know, moving here. Jack has built something out of the show that I think is tremendously wonderful for many people, for lots and lots of listeners. But it has also created the space that he needed to live in here, right? The show is part of Jack living in North Dakota. I don't know that it would have happened if we had gotten jobs in, I don't know, Austin, Texas, or some other kind of place. And sometimes I think those long bike rides across the prairie, you know, are also integral to thinking about the show, possible topics, other kinds of things. It is hard for me to imagine Jack as Jack without the 18 years of this show. It's just a fundamental part of who he is, and it's a part that I really love.
Pop open the champagne because why philosophical discussions about everyday life turns 200, the 200th episode, Sunday, August 9th. Listen in at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain. Why airs every second Sunday of the month here on Prairie Public, and aren't we glad? Jack and Kim, we appreciate all the hard work that goes into this show, behind the scenes, in front of the mic, the elevation of intellect on our air, and without being snobby about it. And man, that is a mad, mad radio skill. Congratulations. And thanks for making the show for our audience, both of you.
Thank you.
I end every episode by saying it's an honor to be with you, and It's a tremendous honor, so thank you.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks, guys.
I'm Bill Thomas, former director of radio for Prairie Public. Jack is pretty much of a natural at on air, which he's probably a natural at talking in the classroom. He's a good conversationalist, does it without sounding like he's dumbing things down. He does manage to get into some fairly deep concepts. Boy, well done. You know, you pulled it together.
Hi, my name is Mick Beltz. I have worked with Jack since 2006. I am a faculty member in ethics. Well, one of the great things about Why Radio is that Jack is able to make all of the areas of philosophy come alive. He is absolutely loved by his students and his colleagues and his coworkers and pretty much everybody at the university. Thank you for doing this.
I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on the rare occasion that Skip Wood was out of office, I got to engineer the Why show. I also interviewed Jack. I always just felt very cared for in a conversation with Jack. He was always aware of his position as being an advocate for the listener. Congratulations, Jack. The world is richer for you being in it.
My name is Paul Thumb, and I am professor at UND. I'm also the department chair of Political Science and Public Administration Department. I've known Jack for over 20 years as a colleague here at UND, but also as a friend. One of the things I appreciate about Jack and the show itself is how much he listens and learns. He elicits a lot of insights from his guests that seem to genuinely surprise him. When you think about 200 episodes, it really makes for an astounding feat.
Hi, this is Skip Wood, former producer at Prairie Public. I had the privilege of engineering the Why Show from its very early days. As a philosophy major myself, I was intrigued when Jack suggested a show that looked philosophically at issues from everyday life. It takes more than a good idea for a show to last. It requires a great host. 200 shows. I'm so glad I got to be part of it. Congratulations, Jack.
Hi, I'm Brian Huschel. I am Vice President for Academic Affairs at Mayville State University currently. And Jack and I got to know each other 25 years ago. He's a great friend, willing to listen. You look at the titles of the episodes, and oftentimes they read like an introduction to philosophy or introduction to applied ethics. But he takes those subjects and interviews these top scholars and manages to connect them into just what's going on in the world today. Why Radio has been great work. I'm happy to listen to it all the time.
My name is Adina Weinstein, and Jack Russell Weinstein is my father. I remember being a little kid in Prairie Public when we'd still have to drive down to Fargo before there was all this, you know, you could do it from his computer now. I remember sitting in his lap with the microphone. I have very vivid memories of the radio station when I was a kid. I think I've learned a lot about what he's willing to open himself up to. He'll never shut down a guest. There's a lot of elitism in academia, and I think it takes guts to say everybody can do philosophy, and I'm not going to be in New York, and I'm going to come to the Prairie, and I'm going to come to North Dakota. And I believe, as an East Coast academic, that people driving in their car on the highway, you know, Grand Forks to Fargo, can listen to philosophy, and they can do it just as well as we can.
Along with the music of his father, renowned jazz flautist Mark Weinstein, who also composed the theme to the show, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, you've just heard from family, friends, and colleagues who are helping Prairie Public celebrate the 200th episode of Why? This Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain. Our congratulations to Jack. It's an honor to share the air with you and make such thoughtful and important topics inviting for everyday listeners. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 4th. On this date in 1910, visitors were already arriving in Williston for a conference that promised to be big. It was for North Dakota newspaper editors. Newspapers were prolific in the state back then, with more than 300 papers around the state. The North Dakota Editorial Association event was expected to attract around 300 men to Williston, with many bringing their families. Some of the editors had published their papers early to accommodate the trip. The city welcomed the multitude by arranging for cars to pick them up from the train station and take them to free entertainment. Apartments were provided, and field trips were planned to see the experiment station, the town's irrigation project, and more. A ball was held one night and a banquet the next. Williston even held a barbecue in the public square. Sam Clark of the Minot Reporter served as toastmaster for the events. In hosting the conference, the city of Williston could show off for the rest of the state and garner extra commerce. The reports written of the convention were good publicity, flattering to Williston and its citizens. The paper in Barlow, in Foster County, noted, "We believe Williston's value must be reappraised, and hereafter it will be known as the City of Achievement." The Globe Gazette in Williston noted that the City of Opportunity had given the pen pushers the best time of their lives. The Lisbon Free Press reported, "We prophesy a great city at Williston, a city of opportunity inhabited by opportunists and deserving the success already attained and that which is yet to come." "They came, were surprised, and satisfied," noted the Williston Graphic, one of several local newspapers publishing there. Interestingly, the editors coming to Williston were near the birthplace of the earliest known newspaper in North Dakota. The Frontier Scout, published in 1864, was set up at nearby Fort Union. Today, fewer than 90 newspapers provide coverage around the state. A copy of each is still sent to the state archives, which has been required by law since 1905. This Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Marie Offutt.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Surveys show declining American support for Israel.
I feel it's lost its way by trying to take too much.
What do Americans say about Israel, and what do Israelis say about America? That story and results from Tuesday's primaries on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Theater Without Walls presents The Cream of Wheat Caper, a melodrama on the Red River, August 15th and 22nd at 7 p.m., and August 16th and 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Myra Museum in Grand Forks. The production is supported by an arts re-grant from the City of Grand Forks with additional support from the Community Foundation of Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and Region.
Listen to Asian View from NHK World Japan Radio every weekday on the station to hear international news, interviews, and deep analysis of what's making headlines with a spotlight on what's happening in Japan and elsewhere in Asia. From the latest stories coming out of China, North Korea, and Myanmar, tune in to Asian View from NHK World Japan Radio and stay up to date with a region that's playing an increasingly important role.
Listen to Asian View weekday afternoons at 5:44 Central on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us, and our sincere congratulations to Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein on his 200th episode of Why: Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. That's a fantastic milestone, and we are happy to celebrate it with the airing of Why this coming Sunday on Prairie Public. Tomorrow on Main Street, Zach Zmed discusses making music with his brother Dylan and preserving the Everly Brothers' legacy and supporting summer theater in Pelican Rapids. That fun discussion with Zach is ahead tomorrow, and we look forward to your joining us again.